This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Filmwax Radio. And you're listening to episode 290 of the podcast. We're coming up fast and furious to episode number 300, aren't we? And I know the that specific episode, what that's going to look like. And actually, if you listen to this show regularly, you know too, because I've mentioned this upcoming guest a bunch of times. And I just need to work on that episode for a little while. It's going to require some work, and so I'm going to make that my 300th episode. But coming up on this episode, number 290, we have, first off, the marketing guru, and he's a producer also and a distributor of films. His name is Mark Schiller. He's been around a long time in entertainment and media, and he was on a show at least a year and a half ago. He was... I remember it quite well, and we were sitting and having dinner, and we did an episode, and it was a great time, and it's taken a long time to get him back on the show, but fortunately, Mark Schiller is back, and we're going to talk about, the evolution of distribution. I think that's, in a nutshell, what he's interested in. He's interested in how we talk about films and what the space looks like in terms of how people are going to market their films and how they're going to reach people. It's quite an interesting time we live in. And there's better films than ever, but man, there's a lot of films coming out. And I don't know how people wade through them, frankly. I know how I do it, but I don't represent the average person by a long shot. So Mark Schiller coming up on the podcast. Also, a friend of mine from the Film Society Lincoln Center, the senior publicist, his name is John Wildman, or his film director moniker is John Stewart Wildman, and he directed a film with my friends, Frank Mosley, who will be in an upcoming episode shortly. He's in it, and Melody Sisk, who was in an episode some time ago, a couple of summers ago, with White Reindeer. She's in it, and Farrah White, who is a producer on the film as well as an actress, who I know somewhat. She's in it, and John is going to talk about it. And John is being joined by his partner in, well, I was going to say crime, but that's corny, so we'll say partner in life and in work, at least as far as film work goes. Her name is Justina Walford. I apologize. Throughout the segment, I called her Justine, so I don't know if she goes by that at all, but clearly her name is Justina, and I apologize to her retroactively for getting that wrong. But I do appreciate both John and Justina for coming on the podcast and talking about this new horror comedy that they made together called Ladies of the House, which is available right now on VOD. All major digital platforms, so go check out that after you listen to the episode. And that's the episode 290. I hope you enjoy it. Mark Schiller, welcome back.
It's great to be back. I enjoyed the last episode. I was eagerly awaiting a part two. So it's
that's nice.
A concentrated time to talk about these things is valuable. I mean, it's great for me to be in these conversations as well. So I enjoy them.
How are you?
I'm good. Yeah? Just got back from Toronto and hot dogs.
Oh, right. How was that?
It was great. It's funny. I've heard so many great things about that festival. And
is that your first time?
First time actually going. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
We've had films play every year there.
Sure.
But scheduling is always difficult for me to make the dates work. But this year we had international premieres of two films, Deep Web and Dishonesty.
Yeah.
Both films that we were in the production side of, that we produced. So I went, and I can see why everybody loves that festival.
Deep Web is Alex Winter.
Alex Winter, yeah.
What's
yeah,
the other one?
The other one is Dishonesty, which is a fantastic documentary on the work of Dan Ariely, who's a behavioral scientist at Duke. Uh-huh. And it's it tackles the science behind lying. Why do we as a human race lie? And it's very timely, obviously, with you know, with in the headlines, stories that have brought that subject to the forefront.
And Brian Williams.
Brian Williams being one, certainly, and others.
I'm sure the filmmaker was probably kicking himself that he probably just they just missed that story.
She.
That's why I said they.
Okay. No. Yael Malamed is a fantastic filmmaker, and we've worked with her in the past on projects, and I was thrilled to be part of the team to bring that film, bring it together.
Were you also producing it?
Yeah, EP. Executive.
Oh, executive producer. Yeah. Is in your case, what do you do? Do you, is that like rainmaking? Is it helping to put together the team?
It's a great question because you're right. I mean, producing, still we still have that question. Like, what does a producer do?
Yeah.
And
I know
for different people, it's different things, mm-hmm. right? For me, it's strategy. I mean, I'm a strategist at heart,
right.
You know, on the marketing side, I'm a marketing strategist. So, you know, I really care deeply about, you know, what is our strategy and, mm-hmm. and how do we execute against it? That's a big part of it. But then, you know, Bond 360 as a, you know, as a distribution arm has great resources. You know, we do all mm-hmm. the creative. We do the, you know, the posters and mm-hmm. the websites and all of that. So it adds a lot of the marketing elements early.
So you had those two at Hot Docs. And I've been wanting to go to...
Go. That's I really great... recommend that people go. Yeah. Toronto is a great city, and it's a great city for films for sure. And it's great when you see the love of documentaries take over a city. And mm-hmm. and it's not just, you know, this kind of niche fan group. It's everybody in Toronto goes to these films, celebrates the craft of documentary filmmaking, and they've got something really special there.
Yeah. I've only heard things like that said about it. I mean, I went to the Toronto, you know, the TIFF, and it's just huge.
TIFF is great. But it's also TIFF. It's one of my favorite festivals, but it's big and different. This is more, this still feels big, meaning that you don't feel like, oh, it's a little thing that gets lost in Toronto. It kind of commands Toronto, mm-hmm. which is nice.
And it's a major industry doc fest.
Yeah.
You know, at this point, or world, you know.
And it's a market, you know, you sell your movies there. That's another great part of it. You know, the international community comes in for it. And so from a business standpoint, Hot Docs is a really good investment, if mm-hmm. you will, mm-hmm. To attend because you will meet people from all over the world.
Yeah. Seriously, my closest friends in the world live in from Toronto, so I stay with them during TIFF. And
so, is the podcast started? By the way, are we?
Yeah.
Are we good? Okay, good.
I think our conversations, you never know
started. Good.
That's the way I do it. I apologize if that's kind of confusing, but
a slight. The reason why I ask is I don't want to swear. I swear a lot, so. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure that I've been trying to cut back on.
I understand, but from my perspective, swearing is fine on the podcast. From yours, it could be the Lloyd Kaufman approach where we shot something with him when uh-huh. he came on my podcast. We sat in his backyard uh-huh. Behind his Upper East Side townhouse.
Very cool.
Where the knocker on the door is Toxic Avenger. You know, uh-huh. it's like toxic. Sure. But in his backyard, he brought out a bottle of wine but he didn't want it seen on the shot. He really felt like that was not a good.
But now everybody knows from the podcast. Now you just let the cat out of the bag.
That's so true. All of his listeners are turning their backs.
Oh, I don't mind. I love wine, so
I know that. But I mean, your cursing was my version. Yes. Like, you know, you didn't want to corrupt the kids out there who might be listening to you. Mark Schiller, executive producer of various documentaries and other film types of projects. Well, I think, you know, we were on, if not 2 years ago, somewhere between a year and two. And back then, Bond 360 was a brand new venture that you were just launching. And you were really excited about it, understandably. And
I still am. Hasn't waned. Still very excited about it.
It's even grown with has some traction now. And it's
definitely.
How is it going? How many films, roughly, for instance, would be under that?
15.
15.
15, which has been a good number because it sounds like a lot, but you know, that lesson that you learn by having a consistent flow of projects has been great because then you can compare things, you can learn from from a diversity of the different types of films. Mm-hmm. So it's been around 15, and we're kind of shooting for 15 a year. Uh-huh. With some of those having theatrical. Yeah, it's a lot, but we have a good big team, and so
as I mentioned, I collaborate a lot with Kino Lorber, and yes. They're certainly doing no fewer than that.
Right.
I mean, they're easily right. Hitting that same number, if not uh-huh. more, actually, which is, but you guys are doing God's work, because, some of the films you're picking up are fairly, I would say, esoteric types of films.
Well, you're right.
Without, I hope that doesn't...
No.
In fact,
it is part of our strategy. It's okay. Part of a strategy to... We want to be the brand that
talks to smart people.
Helps. Well, before we even get to the movie goer, let's talk about the industry. There's a lot of really good movies that, that don't have a team behind them, because when you look at it from purely an economic standpoint, in a very, very challenging market, it doesn't make sense. Well, I want those movies to reach audiences. I want them to have a great trailer and a great campaign and a great poster. And I'm proud that there are certain movies that we brought to audiences specifically because they're great films that deserve it.
Are you going completely by an emotional / cerebral, but mostly emotional response? Or do you see a film... Quality, of course, is there by default. Let's just move on from that. But are you also turned on by the challenge of how you would market a film that's not so obvious? It's not a bromance.
It's both. It's definitely both.
Is it?
I think there are certain films that when I see it, I know immediately this is a movie that fits our model and is a good business decision and a good project. So a film like... Mm-hmm. Advanced Style fits that, right? You just immediately see that film in the context of what we do, and this one's a good decision from a business standpoint. You see a film like Sign Painters, a movie that is about as niche as one can get. It's about, the art of hand lettering and the American, rock stars that are in that world. But the typography community and the art world and design are going to champion this movie for the next, 20 years. Mm-hmm. So that's a decision that you immediately know fits on both levels. And then there's some films where, they've been championed by the community, but they just don't fit into, the rest of the distribution, business models. And we love taking those films on. So we have a film, Tomorrow We Disappear, which is a beautiful, beautiful film. And every time I mention it to anybody, they're like, oh, I love that movie. I'm so happy that you guys are releasing it, mm-hmm. because the movie is tricky when you're just looking at it from a spreadsheet. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a little bit of both. I want to be in the business because I want to champion great, great stories. And I don't want to be in the business because I'm an investor or I'm a businessman looking for,
a big return.
I think it needs to be sustainable. I need to make sure that the business is sustainable, and I like making money, but I'm not doing it with a business objective is the primary driver. And unfortunately, a lot of it is driven by projections and numbers, there's a place for that, but there's also, you have to go with your gut.
Right. I mean, it's always been a business, and it's always been the case.
But we've always
the
had
beginning of cinema.
But look, I mean, I always say it as a bit of a unique situation where films that really don't seem to work in other people's models, we do really well with. Particle Fever, that's a film that we did extremely well with, the first Bond 360 title. And, nobody saw that film coming. Mm-hmm. Nobody felt that movie was going to work. Mm-hmm. But if you follow culture and you follow, science, and the movie delivers both, intellectually and emotionally, it's got great characters as well as great ideas. There was no question in my mind that movie would do well. Mm-hmm. I don't know if anybody else saw that.
Do you have that prescient and understanding? I have a vision for this, how to strategically release this film, and you can just see it happening. I mean, and it's, I'm not being goofy about this. I mean, I'm actually wondering if you you can kind of almost see it like a,
yeah,
that way.
But a lot of, I mean, look, it's easy for people to say, oh, I'm a, you know, I saw, you know, I created a, you know, a roadmap, and all we did was execute the roadmap, and the roadmap was brilliant from the beginning.
Yeah.
That's not really how it works, because some of it's about timing. Is the right theaters open in the dates that you want?
Right.
Did the person that you know, opens five more doors, you know, fall into place early? It's kind of, you know, success is like a dominoes, right? Mm-hmm. If you line up the dominoes in the right way, the first one falls and the dominoes start to fall, and part of it's lining them up, but there's also, you know, a real momentum that builds that you can't predict all aspects of.
Well, we've been focusing on 360, which is the distribution part of your world, your business, but there's also a marketing and publicity, or
that's part of Bond 360. You know, that, okay.
Bond Influence
is the larger company that has a whole range of services, but that goes beyond film. That's, you know, we do a lot of corporate work for, you know, a whole range of types of companies. We work, you know, across hospitality. So we have we've had, you know, the Starwood Hotels groups, their brands as clients for 10 years. We've worked with GE for 3.5. We've worked for, we would now work with HP. So Bond Influence is a larger entity that has a large strategy component to it.
So for when it comes to marketing,
yeah,
specifically the films, does that become part of the Bond 360
yeah,
team?
It does.
Rather than the Influence team,
yeah,
which is right. Then they can focus
that's
on.
Right.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. And there's crossover, you know, because you get smarter. I mean,
sure,
you get smarter when you do things that are pulling in new thinking and new ideas. And so, you know, people that come to work here, you know, that are, you know, on the publicity side of film or on the distribution side, you know, one of the reasons why I think they come is that they get an opportunity to work on a project for HP or for Park Hyatt Hotels.
Mm-hmm.
And that experience gives them, you know, new inputs, new ideas,
sure,
and new thinking.
Right. I mean, you can definitely get into a rut. I mean, if you want to call it that, you sort of start thinking in a confined mental space after a while. I mean, it's bound to happen. But if you do that, all of a sudden, if you start working on some other thing that's unrelated completely, you can all of a sudden opens doors and you're opens up.
Well, the biggest one is retail. I mean, the biggest learnings that, I mean, when you move into the digital world and you're looking at the importance of transaction, right? Mm-hmm. Buying a movie, mm-hmm, whether it's iTunes or what have you, you're in the retail business. And there's a lot of really smart lessons in retail that come from the fashion world, come from, you know, the web startups that have been selling products for a mm-hmm long time that typically don't get brought into the world of film. Mm-hmm. You know, film is pretty much a B2B business, right? You know, you sell to the big marketplaces, you sell to mm-hmm iTunes, you sell to, you know, to Netflix, and then they handle,
because,
you know, the
customer side of it. Yeah.
Right. But it's evolving into a B2C business, business to consumer. So not just business to business. Now it's becoming a business to consumer business.
Mm-hmm.
Individual filmmakers have embraced that. And there's, you know, we can, you know, put a list together of filmmakers that have, really succeeded in understanding their fan base and B2C, right?
Mm-hmm.
Their business to consumer. But have companies evolved into B2C? Well, that's why we launched Bond 360, because they're not yet. They're not set up to do that. That's not how they operate. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see if other distributors and other companies as a company moves into B2C. But most of them are B2B. You know, they're
yeah,
business
I understand
to business.
Right. I don't know how a distributor would use, let's say, the tools that allow, for instance, a filmmaker to screen their film on their website, for instance, where they get paid directly by the consumer. But how does
Well, they could look, I mean, what they most often do is look at it as just another B2B, right? So they look at, you know, the two or the three biggest are, you know, VHX, certainly, and Vimeo and Gumroad, right? And so
What's the third?
Gumroad.
And
so what a lot of distributors do is they say, okay, well, if, you know, VHX is going to be, you know, a player in this world, we'll just put our films up on VHX like we put up our films on, you know, iTunes. And so they're looking at it from a B2B standpoint.
Yeah.
That's not going to make any money for anybody, because just to have the film in another place doesn't mean that you're able to increase sales. So that's kind of wave one that happens. Mm-hmm. And then wave two is, will they evolve into an entity that has strategies on pricing and strategies on fan bases that can be converted into customers and customers across their slate of movies? And, you know, I didn't want to wait for that to happen, right? I didn't want to say, okay, well, eventually, mm-hmm. you know, others will move into the space, so I'll be relying on them to sell my movies to them, and I'll wait for that to happen. I wanted to do it. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, that's why we launched the distribution arm.
So what is an example of B2C then that might work?
Sign Painters is a great example of B2C, right?
What is it?
Sign Painters, this movie that we released. It's available on iTunes, available on Google and Vudu and all of the different outlets, as it should, you know, and they are great partners for the film. But you go to Sign Painters website and there's, you know, a deluxe version of the movie. There's, nice. You can buy, if you saw the movie on iTunes and you just want the bonus content, you can buy only the bonus content. There's, DVDs that are bundled with, limited edition t-shirts. So that's the front end, right? But back end is really where there's the great value, is that we have the database of buyers and customers, and we can do an event and invite people locally, and we can evolve the relationship over time. And that's a different way to how to manage a business. You can't just do that if you're not structured to do it, mm-hmm. you know? So,
right.
So there's lots of examples of that. For the right film, you know, the B2C business is quite good.
I think I popped into one distribution conversation at South by Southwest, which was talking specifically what you're talking about. Unfortunately, the Bond was not represented on that panel. They should have been.
Why the hell not? They didn't.
That's obviously an egregious error. But there was the folks from your ex neighbors. The Orchard was there. I can't remember. One of the big examples was that I'm going to forget everything today because I normally have to run through it. The TV show
Harmontown.
Yeah, Harmontown.
Yeah. That's Neil Berkeley.
Yes. Yeah, that was some place that really tapped into what you're talking about.
You know, there's an example where if that film did not have a structure to do, you know, those B2C direct businesses, it would have lost a huge opportunity, because here you have, you know,
an enormous following that.
Well, not only that, and there's more and more Dan.
And
there's more and more Dan Harmons out there. Where are they going to go? You know, I want them to go to Bond 360. I want them to come to us, because mm-hmm. there's more people that are coming with an asset, and their asset is a business that's a fan base, and that fan base is organized. That fan base is motivated to buy. That fan base is different than just
loyalty is big time
and,
loyalty.
The creator, if you will, whether it's Dan Harmon or others, are diversified in their creativity. They're not just making movies. They're doing books, and they're doing, you know, live events, and they're doing all these things. Where does that person go with their movie? Mm-hmm. Well, I want to be the answer to that. And mm-hmm. and that's really the bet, is that the creative community is changing. It's evolving. And what is the structure for that creator to have a partner that is set up to optimize the opportunities for mm-hmm. that work? So, you know, we started working, since we spoke, with people like Ricky Lake and her partner Abby on the business of being born as a business. You know, that's a film, and the more business being born was afterwards, that still every year it's an annuity. It still has a, you know, loyal fan base. You go to, you know, the iTunes doc charts and that film will be there. The film came out, you know, years ago. And what Ricky and Abby have been doing is they've been bringing more films, more films about birthing and mothers and the birthing process into the fold as mm-hmm. executive producers. So now you have this growing business. Who manages that business? Who what do? Do you hire a bunch of interns? And then how do you learn what best practices are? Mm-hmm. Who runs the business? So Bond 360 was set up to partner and to work with people like Abby and Ricky Lake because they need infrastructure, they need a business, and they don't want to just sell it. Mm-hmm. They want to be able to be involved. There's other people. I see, you know, Spike Lee going in this direction. I've worked with Spike this year. I've seen, you know, other creative people that, you know, we worked with Kevin Spacey on a project. And so I think that as people start to move in this direction, we need new structures for them.
Right. There seems to be a lot of people who are working on projects, but they're not interested in doing this conventional huge release in the, you know, just the historical way, but they're trying to do projects that are specifically designed to connect with a community of people over a certain subject of you know, right, that they share in common.
Yeah, that you can define a community, but you want that community to be, you know, evolving and growing. And, you know, I don't want to acquire a movie only because it has a very small community and I know how to get to that community.
Yeah. People that have babies are, you know, it's a growing.
And every year there's new.
This is, of course.
There's new babies come in. And there's certain movies that are timeless. And that's why, you know, people are like, do you only do documentaries? And my answer is no. Like, I'm not saying I'm only going to do documentaries. Don't ever bring me a, you know, a narrative fiction piece. But what I love with documentaries is that there are certain documentaries that, first of all, there's a lot of diversification in terms of kind of press and media. You know, we're not just relying on the entertainment press to write about us. We can go to, on some movies, 30 different genres of press, political press, environmental press, you know, business press, this press, that press, for a single movie because of the diversity of issues or subjects. Also, a really good doc has a very long shelf life because certain movies are timeless, you know, and those movies will always be there, and they'll always be germane, you know. I mean, look, I didn't distribute them, but in, you know, I cut my teeth as a marketer on, you know, films like Extra Through the Gift Shop in Senna, and those movies are timeless. They're not going to suddenly somebody's going to say, oh, well, didn't Senna come out, you know, 10 years ago? No, whoever finds, you know, Senna today, it's as fresh to them as it was when the movie came out.
Sure.
You know, years ago.
Right. And those two are in particular very, well, certainly Senna, very cinematic and very also as well. You know, compelling.
Gift Shop is extremely cinematic.
Yeah.
And look, they're great, great movies. I mean, they're also at the top of the heap in terms of just the quality of those movies are very high.
So how are you finding these projects? How do you?
Lots of different ways.
I mean, I know you're going to obviously Hot Docs and you mentioned.
I mean, I think it's word of mouth really. You keep your ear to the ground and you find projects. I mean, I think we're getting into producing because we are hearing about projects earlier and we don't want to wait until, you know, they go to a festival and they have a sales agent and they have a publicist and suddenly we're like,
fait accompli in a sense, or you're now competing on a new level where,
right,
we want to be part of the development of it.
Correct. And we want to shape the film and offer strategy and creative services early. So we have a film that I'm really excited about that's in production now called Perfect 14, which is on plus size models and certainly body image, which is in the news now all the time. But more than that, it's about the rise of the blogger as celebrity and these women who are changing, you know, girls and not just girls, but girls are certainly responding to it, are celebrities because they're on the web. So I'm really excited about this film. I didn't want to wait for that film to be, you know, finished and at a festival and me, you know, getting online with, you know, with other distributors to then, you know, bid for it. So the filmmakers were fantastic and understood, you know, that we were on the same page and then we came in early.
Yeah, it's great. And so this deals with body image.
Yeah.
That's great.
But it's more than that. It's like, it's like a thing about, you know, advanced style that I love and why that film also is a film that will be in the conversation for forever is that, you know, it's kind of like a fashion movie, right? You have these elderly ladies that, you know, are dressed to the nines with these crazy fashions that, you know, that the film depicts. But if you go online and you look at the comments of people that see the movie, it's really about a much deeper message, you know, not fearing getting older. And people are, you know, these ladies are using fashion as a way to live in the moment, to not fear death. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a 16-year-old girl watches that movie and they idolize these women that are in their 80s and 90s. And that's, for me, the reason why I love that movie is not a fashion genre.
Right.
But that it's a movie that has a subtle, it's entertaining, but has a subtle, deeper message.
It's not I don't even know if it's subtle.
It's not an issues doc. Like, nobody's going to say, nobody's going to say advanced style is about aging. They're not. Well, and that's a good thing because it's not typecast.
Right. That's true. In fact, it succeeds by just even the conversation. And those are the movies that I love.
And those are the movies that I love, you know, that they're not, you know, selling themselves as a impact or issues film. They're selling themselves as a really great story with great characters, and they have a deeper message.
No, I know what you mean. I think I must have seen that one because that sounds like
haven't seen it, I'll give you the DVD.
No. I think I did see it because I like the idea that, well, first, people that are older, because elderly is a state of mind. Older is just kind of a demographic, I suppose. But you're becoming visible, largely. And I think that's true with historically, or at least in the last decades, with women that are heavy.
Sure.
Just the emphasis of what we've, you know, as a society, seems like we've been out of whack with our priorities. And finally, what I'm seeing is maybe some early signs that women that are larger can be considered beautiful again. And that would be great if like to be in a conversation that deals with that would be very exciting. I could see that because it could actually make a difference in the culture.
It will make a difference.
Yeah. There's that vision I was talking about where you could see it happening and then make it happen.
Oh, do we have to wrap it up?
Well, according to my
assistant. Wow. That's going to make it sound like there's 20 people waiting, you know, with clipboards or something behind me.
In lab coats.
Yeah, in lab coats. Well, no.
I know. It's hard because the truth is that you do get a certain – well, we didn't have a particular agenda, like, but I feel like there was a really
What are the best meetings when you set the next meeting up? So let's put in the calendar the next one.
Sure. It was great to hear from
you about – I always love doing this. Let's do it. Let's do it again.
You bet.
Cool. Thanks.
He's a really great guy. Mark, I know you're listening. We should have a regular thing, I think. We need to do state of distribution, state of film. What do you think? If you are into that, I am. We could do something every few months. I don't see why not. And then, John Wildman, I know for a number of years from the Film Society Lincoln Center, where he's the senior publicist. So I interact with him quite a bit, and his colleague David Nin. They're both terrific. They help me out setting up interviews for the podcast when there's a series or festival going on at the society. They are also very helpful in terms of just hooking me up there in case I need to get into something or need a ticket or what have you. So it was a really nice turn of events when I found out a while ago that John was a filmmaker now, and he made this film, and we were able to invite him onto the podcast as a filmmaker. And so this is a different dynamic, and I welcomed it, and I think it came out pretty well. There's a little trailer here, and then we'll go into the conversation with John and his partner, Justina, right now.
Birthday boy, want a present like that?
Oh, okay.
Well, follow her.
But home?
A stripper will go home with you if you ask the right way.
Happy birthday, Clyde Clinks.
I'm taking charge.
Fight back. Fight more.
The thing about bringing dates home is you need to choose wisely.
Are you mad?
No.
We're going to get your friends. When the
sun fades away. I usually show some mercy at this stage. But I don't like the way you acted in my home. You're a bad man.
Did they do this to you?
I just want to do what I do.
The place is a mess! Clean it up!
Welcome, John Stewart Wildman. I should go by your filmmaker.
Go by the full director name.
Your directorial moniker. And Justine Walford.
Hi, yes, Justina Walford.
Welcome you both.
It's great to be here. This is great to do this. I'm kind of excited to be on this side of it with you.
Yeah, that's right. Finally, we've known each other for at least 5 years.
Yeah, absolutely. From when I first came to New York City.
Yeah, I remember the day I met you. Even I don't remember anything from that day. I do remember meeting you, though. More importantly, I remember meeting you, and it's been a smooth, great trip so far.
Absolutely.
But you're right. You've helped kind of me connect to countless interviews, and now you're in that chair.
Yeah, it's fun. I mean, since we started doing the film festival tour with the film, I've had a lot of, you know, about it. I've had a year now of these experiences of me being on a red carpet instead of running a red carpet, mm-hmm. or me being an interview subject instead of setting it up for someone else or interviewing someone myself. And so that's been fun, mm-hmm. a little surreal, a little weird. And it's been fun to have Justina do it because she's not within all of that. So it is all shiny and new for her in that regard.
Yes, totally new for me. I have no idea how to deal with a microphone.
You're doing marvelously.
Thank you.
A little bit of background. So I know, John, you're from Dallas. Well, is that not true?
No, I'm from L.A.
Okay,
and but for quite a while I was the director of PR for the Dallas International Film Festival, and still have ties there. In fact, we have a home there, which we got specifically to shoot this film, mm-hmm. and still have that home. But yeah, we have very strong ties to Dallas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm from L.A. That's where we actually met.
Okay.
And I had a theater for 3 years, so I was a playwright first, and then started writing screenplays after that.
Oh, nice. Have you transitioned into the arts, Justine, in New York City? I know how hard that can be. You have this project, but outside of that.
Yeah, when we moved to New York, I was actually really intimidated by New York.
Sure, of course.
So I did theater in L.A., and I thought, oh, I could never do theater in New York. I'm sure it's just Broadway. And then after a couple years, I was like, oh, no, yeah. There's some really bad theater out there. I can compete with this.
There is. And yet, you're right. I didn't think you were going to say that, but yes. Hey, I could do a lot less worse than that. That's a good way of approaching
it. I could not suck. I could not suck. And yet, I think I've done some speaking. Like I host something called Sunday Assembly, and I've done some storytelling, mm-hmm. but I actually haven't really dove into the theater.
Is it autobiographical stories, or are you making them up?
Yeah, pretty much autobiographical or just philosophical or, you know, wandering mind stuff.
But it's written.
Written, yeah.
Yeah, it's not improvised. Yeah.
No, no.
Right. I'm always, you know, by anybody who can write and tell great stories is always something impressive. But I'm also like, how there are people that improvise also. Like, that's just incredible. Either way.
Yeah, I think when I had a theater, I did that. I would actually get on stage and I'd say, name a subject, and I will tell you that part of my life or mm-hmm. that story or something. And it's really fun, but it can go really amazing or go really badly. So it's a very risky thing, improvising dramatically.
Sure.
Storytelling is risky.
Yeah. I mean, ostensibly, we're here to talk about this project that you both collaborated on called Ladies of the House. It's a, I would say, a dark comedy / horror film.
That's fair.
Nobody's interrupted me, so I'm going to continue.
That's fair. That's fair. Continue. Please go on.
The reason I was excited to talk to you guys is because I would have said 5 years ago when we first met, I wouldn't have been interested because I was kind of more snobby. I don't think snobby really because I was still very open to emotional stories, but I wanted that emotional tour or, you know, something. I was not as open-minded to that genre of film. But over time, I have become much more curious about it and have seen a lot more. And I've now turned around 180, where I really do, when it's well made and it's funny and also shocking and thrilling, it's fun to go. And it's a nice contrast to the other types of films.
Well, you know, that's one of the reasons we, Justina and I, love working within the genre format. And we love doing that because, one, we enjoyed ourselves a great deal. And two, there is a different expectation that we feel that we can counter and we can surprise. And much like ambitions that we had with this film in particular, that we can play with some things, some themes, we can hit some politics that indirectly, and yes, you know, I've always been someone that championed genre films at my other jobs at various film festivals as a publicist, because I always wanted people to respect them and give them the respect that I thought they were due as filmmaking, mm-hmm. as works of art. And so, I mean, we're basically doing what I've been championing this entire time on the other side again. It's ourselves that are putting this out there. And yeah, and I'm looking very forward to a lot of people like yourself that may not be obvious horror film aficionados, may not be people that just hunger for whatever comes out in the various midnight categories at film festivals.
Yeah, which are the genre films for those? Which who are don't more know. Mostly genre films in the
more often than not, those are the genre films exactly,
and other kinds of ironic horror, those types of things.
Yes,
or whatever. I forgot to mention before we were chit chatting about how we met, and I didn't say that you are the senior publicist at the Film Society of Lincoln Center.
That's correct.
I don't think I mentioned it. So in the movie, you collaborated on this. How long did it take to write it, to go into production, to finish it?
Well, I mean, it went through a number of very typical stages that independent films go through. The writing and development of it, Justine and I wanted to work on something together. We had both had our individual scripts that just didn't seem like the thing to do to start off with, and we were trying to come up with an idea. And Justina jokingly said, Cannibal Strippers, mm-hmm. and I said, that's it.
Yeah.
I said, if you write that, I will figure out a way to make it. And she began writing, and at a certain point I joined in with her, but it was her story, her idea. And that writing process took about a year or so?
Oh, I think 2 years. We actually did table reads also. We played around with it quite a bit. So we really, really honed the script. And then, and then production was actually fast.
We were set to make the movie after, I think, that 2 year period, and we could only come up with half of the budget. And so then we tabled it because we just could not get over the hump. Mm. The second half. And I didn't want to be, for my first time out as a director, I did not want to be in that position where you start filming mm-hmm. and you hope you'll get the money to finish it.
No.
Because the stories always sound romantic afterwards. Like, me and my producer and I were in the kitchen yeah. and we didn't know how to pay the crew right. as we were shooting the last shot. And I did not want to be that person. So we tabled it and we wrote something else. And we were then planning to make that film, and we got the budget, pretty much the entire budget, to shoot that second film, and we decided we needed more money for something, for the budget, mm-hmm. and one of the primary investor in the film, we had to go back to that person and ask them for more budget. And our other main producer on this, Farrah White, she told me, as I was telling her what we needed to do, she said, they like this script. They really love the other one. And so with, I think, a month and a half, 2 months before we shot, we went back to the original script. We flipped it.
Brought the patty back over on it.
Exactly. And we shot this film. So I would say 5 years later, here we are.
So you had raised, it sounded like, half the budget, roughly, of movie A, which of course now is the movie we're talking about, which is Ladies of the House. And then went for a second film, raised the majority of that, then went back to the first film. How does that work out, though, if you've raised money from – did you raise it yourself? Did you reach out? Did you have, like, investors come in?
We had
meaning family, friends, dentists, etc.
Correct. I think we had three main investors.
Okay. And they didn't have a problem.
And myself. And, yeah. And we went to each one of them and said – here's the situation.
Okay.
And all of them were on board.
Right. That makes sense. And then when did the Kickstarter come in?
The Kickstarter came in while we were filming, just prior, and then during filming. And that was for post and finishing funds. And we actually had that Kickstarter campaign as we were filming.
Right.
So
I think I remember that now.
Yeah. So we would film during the day, and then that evening after we went through dailies for that day shoot, then I would retire to my bedroom, which is actually in the studio. I actually slept in the studio while we shot, and only left three times during the course of the 18-19 day shoot. And I would go back to my dressing room, which I was sleeping in the studio, and then send out a couple hundred emails every night
for that
Kickstarter campaign.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's like endless amount of anecdotes and just material around a Kickstarter campaign, isn't there? I mean, you could just go, the amount of work.
You're basically, you're the star of your own Jerry Lewis telethon for a month. Mm-hmm. And it's a daily process of trying to figure out how to inspire people to contribute, and it was easily the toughest part of the entire process of all the filming, everything that we did. The Kickstarter campaign was the toughest part for me.
Raising money is the toughest part of anything. Kickstarter is like a full-time job.
Yeah,
it's on top always, of a full-time job. Yeah.
Right, it's always what. The term that's applied to it. Well, I was reminded during the credit scroll that I was effectively solicited, and because I
think
was
you're
in
listed
there.
As a friend of the family.
Oh, okay, I think it wasn't something like kicked or something. What? I know.
Kick in the pants.
Okay. Oh, kick in the pants. Oh, okay. That's like that? It. Then you're one of the kick in the pants people.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. But it was, I said, I vaguely remember contributing to this, and I had to wait to be reminded. Well, you mentioned Farrah, who's a producer on the film, but she's also a star in the film. Farrah White, who has not been on this podcast, but I met her, I think, through you. And then there are a couple of people who I know in the film. Frank Mosley, who is a character in the film, a memorable character. I think his nickname was Piggy.
Piglet.
Excuse me. Got to get that right. Piglet. I'm not going to give anything away about it. Just a very memorable member of the house.
For fans of Frank Mosley, who is just an amazingly prolific actor, director, filmmaker, makes some of these most exquisite art films. They're just wonderful. And this is a role that anybody who appreciates him, no one would expect him to be doing this.
Awesome. Yeah. He was up here recently, as you know, and we recorded a segment. I haven't put it up yet, so I'm telling you this as I have, of course, put up our segment. So I'm not sure the order of everything, but likely this will go first. But we do talk about Ladies of the House, and he does set it up. But people will probably hear that later on, his role, and it's worth hearing. I had just been to the Nashville Film Festival. I just got back. Where I saw Lady of the House.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we screened at Nashville. That was our, I think that was, that is our festival swan song before the movie opens on VOD.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good. Yeah. So I saw it there, and I had also seen Frank in Some Beast. So it was a doubleheader.
That's so Frank. He takes over all the film festivals.
Well, he's one of the actors that does. That's for sure. There's a few. Then also in the film is Melody Sisk, who is worked a lot with Zach Clark, right? Who is an owner to Cal. Has kind of collaborated with both of them in acting and in producing capacities. So Melody always memorable in whatever she does.
Melody, we are so team Melody, Justina and I. I couldn't even. We could spend the entire podcast just talking about her.
She didn't produce it all. She just acted.
She was just in the cast, but she was a late addition to the cast, and in many ways saved our filmmaking asses, mm-hmm. and also just delivers. Just a fantastic performance. We've had some critics that have said some great things about her for very good reason. But she just really did amazing in this film.
Yeah, Getty is actually a difficult role to cast.
That's her character's name.
Yeah,
she's one of the four mm-hmm. roommate/strippers, mm-hmm. right?
And
just to set it up a little bit.
She'd be mm-hmm. kind of the father figure of of the nuclear family of cannibal strippers. So.
Yeah, right. If you're having a cannibal stripping family, Melody's the dad.
Melody's, exactly.
Got it. The mother is definitely Farrah.
Yes.
Right? Yes. And who are the other two ladies of the house?
And then the daughter, of course, none of them are related, but the daughter.
In the dynamic.
The character of Crystal is played by Brina Palencia.
Okay.
Brina, who has a lot of fans from the CW show Star-Crossed.
Okay.
And also is a major anime voice artist.
Oh.
And so she is someone that you're going to see a lot of, and she is wonderful in this role. And in fact, when she was the one person, other than Farrah, who was mm-hmm. also a producer on it, mm-hmm. she was the one person that was part of the project, had been cast pretty much, or we were intending to cast her on the first go round, mm-hmm. and then mm-hmm. after we tabled it and came back, we immediately reached out to her and said, "We want you to read again. We want to see you again," because she made such a huge impression on us the first time around. So yeah. So there's Brina Palencia, mm-hmm. and then the fourth of our foursome is the character of Ginger, who's the new girl, the new addition to this quartet, and she's played by Michelle Sinclair, otherwise known as Belladonna, for a lot of the fans in the adult film world. And this was...
You only had her for a day on the set, I guess.
Oh, no, no. We had her for a week. And this was her first non-adult feature film that she did. Now, following her work with us, and she was amazing and wonderful and easily the most popular person on the set while she was there, because she's just mm-hmm. a joy, just awesome. But following her work with us, she then went on to work with Paul Thomas Anderson on Inherent Vice.
So you discovered her, is what you're saying.
Yes, that is what we're saying, definitely.
And then tossed him a bone, is you helped him out, because he, poor guy.
I'm just laying out how this timeline worked out.
You're just,
This is all I'm saying.
For struggling directors like that, we just want to give them a gift.
That is really selfless. So Belladonna now what they would call, I don't know, legit actor.
She's wonderful in this. She was awesome in Inherent Vice. We think the world of her.
Well, this is an interesting way to transition a little bit, then out of the typical conversation about making the film, to this subject of sex, of feminism, because of as you're mentioning Belladonna, I don't know who she is. I understand there are some people take their clothes off in films and have sex public.
So we hear.
Consumption.
So we hear.
All right. Right. And I don't know why
people do this.
Families are sitting around watching naked people screwing. Apparently. No, but there seems to be something going on with this now. Just recently, I'll say in the last 5-10 years, and there have probably been some exceptions in very specific exceptions. But now there seems to be something larger going on, which is the line between the porn industry and the legit film industry. I'm using that word because it's kind of the way it's been used in the past. But even that could change the way we talk about porn versus non-porn. And it's getting the line in between seems fuzzier because of a couple of actors like Belladonna, that's her name? And Sasha Gray, that's the one I was thinking of. And it seems like it, therefore, only a matter of time before we're not really looking at it as a binary thing. Like, it's just, it's another type of storytelling in a way.
I really hope so, because we also have mainstream film becoming more overt
right.
sexually. So you have yeah. like a Short Bus was, which was I thought had real sex, right? Short Bus had real sex.
Real penetration, you mean?
Yeah.
Okay. And then more recently we had
Nymphomaniac.
Paul Schrader.
And Paul Schrader's film.
Right. Which
The Canyons.
The Canyons. Right.
With James Dean.
James Dean, who's a male porn actor, obviously, in a non-porn role as well. So
correct.
It seems like it seems inevitable that this is just the way it's going. Like
and pornography actually went through a very difficult stage where the internet pretty much just made it lose the money making that it was.
Well, we call it democratizing,
right?
Putting all those people out of work, I guess. You know?
And so now pornography has to actually mainstream to be able to find a way to monetize.
They're very motivated.
Yes.
Yeah,
so
that's true.
So we saw, and even before the internet started sort of democratizing it, you saw them saying, like, we had to figure something out, and the industry really changed and tried to create plot-driven pornography, which, you know, had mixed reviews.
Yeah.
Some people don't want that with their porn. So it was definitely like we're exactly what you're saying. It's going to no longer be a binary thing very right. soon, I think. Not that our film is. There's no porn in our film.
No. It's much more out there. No, in some ways. Well, I mean, since we know they're cannibals, there's no... I mean, we can just say they'll build a little bit more of the plot, because I do want to get into the women and what the themes of the film are beyond the plot. You know, so because they bring back... Basically, these guys, three friends, two of which are brothers, go to the strip joint. They're trying to get one of them laid, and maybe I think, and they follow the strippers, unbeknownst to the strippers, I think they follow them home. They follow them to their house, which is their kind of minor mistake. so then the mayhem ensues. But these characters are very specific. Their look is very specific. Obviously, I don't know if you had conversations saying, well, on a metaphorical level. They're eating these guys, but really what maybe was going on here is they're strippers, but they're also very empowered. They're not like victims.
Well, we've discussed quite a bit about the fact that oftentimes when you're discussing women in horror films, you fall into variations of
right.
two camps. Either the woman is a victim / survivor, mm-hmm. or the woman is a monster. And, you know, and more or less, you know, things fall into those two areas. What we wanted to do was create a world where the men were actually superfluous. Like we wanted to sweep all of that aside and basically create a world where men in almost every way were at service
mm-hmm.
to the women. And
most blatantly with Mosley.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I was hoping that we'd be like one of the first ones to like really do this. You know, you always have that ambition of breaking ground. And then what was it? Grace, Paul Soleil's film, you know, wonderful film, came out as going, oh, he got there. He got there first in a major way. And then Lucky McKee's The Woman also, I thought, fell into this kind of characterization. The Woman?
The Woman. Okay.
Yeah.
That's the name of the film, Lucky McKee.
Lucky McKee is the filmmaker.
Okay, another one. Okay.
Yeah.
And May,
which is also by Lucky McKee. And so they also deal with this in kind of this way of, again, not having woman as victim or right. as monster,
yeah.
but literally it's a woman's world.
Yeah, I think, you know, when I write, and when I watch horror, actually, the delectation of female fear doesn't appeal to me. So... as a woman, to me, I think we live our lives in fear most of our day. Like we're careful when we walk home. We avoid certain neighborhoods. We do this thing so that when I watch a horror film and it's all scared woman running, whether she survives or not,
right for the woods.
Yeah, and I'm like, I don't. Yeah. It doesn't appeal to me. Whether she survives or not doesn't appeal to me.
Often for being as a result of being sexual.
Yes. Yeah, but also, you know, even the
even when they're not, but
the
I mean,
virginal hero does it too. Like, she's still
right.
she has to be afraid the whole movie that she's going to die.
Okay.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
and I like the idea, and it's not actually even power as much as just, I guess it's power, but more of a being able to confidently live life. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to create characters that confidently lived life, And these women don't seem to be scared when they go home at night. They don't seem to be. I kind of made that fantasy happen. They're definitely the darker selves. They're shadow selves of a female, of our female personalities. But I really liked creating women that were a little above the day to day.
And we kind of hoped that we would create a film where, if we did our jobs properly, there would be a shifting of loyalties throughout the film. Like, you know, you would think, well, obviously, you know, our cannibals are the bad guys or bad girls. But in a way you go, well, the guys are encroaching on their territory. So they're kind of getting what they deserve. But do they deserve to be, be victimized? So we were hoping to have that kind of film.
Right. Do they deserve necessarily to be filleted?
Exactly. Yeah. So you're hoping, for me, in the best case scenario, that as people leave the theater, that they have to chew on the film. Like, they have to go and discuss it.
Interesting choice of words.
Thank you. But they can't escape it that quickly.
Right. Yeah. Well, John, do you consider yourself a feminist?
I would consider myself a feminist, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I see, you know, by your posts on Facebook, which, no, I'm not going to. You're putting yourself out there, your thoughts out there very blatantly, right? I mean, you are definitely writing stuff that's going to be provocative.
Very much so.
I mean, you're trying to start conversations. It's clear, right?
So, I'm not shy.
No,
I'm not shy, right, to give my opinions. And yes, I think the film is absolutely reflective of of my personal feminism.
I'm wondering how much like this collaboration, this partnership, because we haven't said it, but I imagine most people have figured out that you both are a married couple, so you're working professionally together, as well as you have a personal partnership.
Yeah. Absolutely.
But were you this way before you met Justine? Did you think about these things? Or, I mean, it's always an definitely through my marriage, I changed a huge amount. Like, I would have considered myself very progressive before I got married, very progressive. But I didn't even have an inkling of understanding what was involved on a personal level to walk the walk. To live a life in practice.
I think my politics and my outlook were, I brought that into the relationship, but the relationship and partnership really, if anything, accented it and emphasized it. You know, it's funny, anybody that, you know, that has like a respect for the history of film or sense of, like, knows who the players were, knows who the artists were or what have you, you know, are smart enough to know, well, this stuff has been done before me.
Yeah.
And, you know, and one of the things that I oftentimes look at, and I've said in the past that with Justina and I, like I look at like the relationship, say, between Peter Bogdanovich and Polly Platt, and how important Polly Platt was to the creation of those amazing films that they did together, and yet arguably she didn't get as much credit as I and a lot of people would have thought she deserved. Hitchcock and his relationship with his wife and how influential she was in the creation of so many, you know, films that have, like, you know, seminal films for us, in the same way. And so I've always looked at the relationship between Justina and I as, in many ways, like those. Like, I entertain the idea that we could rise to that level, that we could, you know, someday be considered that after we do hopefully more work. The difference is that I make no bones about the fact that, you know, say in this case, it was her story. I mean, primarily her script. There's so many decisions. She had many of the costuming decisions. So much, you know, she and I were working absolutely just hand in hand together.
Mm-hmm. Last thoughts, Justine.
Feminism. I think feminism has changed so much in the last few years that it's kind of hard to say. Like, I think, I'm a different feminist than before I met John, and actually than before I made the film. Like, I think that's what's so amazing. I think that we evolve so much.
This is what I don't think about. Yeah, you could be maybe consider yourself a feminist now. When Beyonce labels herself as identifies herself as a feminist, you're right. And maybe she is. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I think also there's so many different kinds of feminists.
If you're groundbreaking, you sell more albums than any guy, does that mean you're a feminist? I'm not sure, but...
Yeah, I hope so. I hope that's what it means.
Here's an interesting thing that happened on this film, with the whole feminist aspect. Had I been left to my own devices, there would have been much less nudity in the film. One, because I'm a Boy Scout.
You're selling tickets, go.
And two, because I had this idea, because of the nature of the film, mm-hmm. that the men would be objectified, and right. so the bulk of the nudity would actually be from the guys, in a way. Mm-hmm. And I was almost ridiculed on that idea by Justina and by Farrah and by Melody.
Yeah.
And I was clearly outvoted. And, you know, and they basically said, no, you have women that look like Farrah and Melody and Brina and Michelle, you know, not that all of them, you know, take their clothes off. But if you have women like that, then for heaven's sakes, you know, that's something, you know, you don't want to shy away from. And so, mm-hmm. again, if it was up to me, it would be a PG movie in that respect. But the women overruled me. And so, therefore, you will have some awesome nudity.
Didn't one of the actresses say, "Get me while I'm young"?
Yeah.
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 I had to add that. My
actress, Brooke Bloom, who recently did this film, she's lost control.
Yeah, she's lost control. Anya Marquette's movie.
Right. Anya Marquette. Right.
Anya Marquette.
She joked about that on the podcast. She said, you know, because she did nudity in her film, and she's, you know, she said, yeah. Get this while the pups, you know. She's really funny about it. She goes, she's so funny, this woman. I've been like a fan of hers, you know, and very, you know, obscure indie film actress, more known for stage work, but I had her on recently. I did a TV thing and a podcast thing because I was just so enamored with them both, Anya and Brooke, but she kind of said the same thing. Ladies of the House on VOD.
May 1st.
May the 1st. So as you listen to this, it will be available. You can turn this off in a minute.
And you can go on directly all on those different platforms, iTunes, Amazon Prime, Vudu, Hulu.
Time Warner.
What's
Verizon,
that?
Verizon, Cox, all the cable on demand stuff.
All the platforms,
all
as
the
they
platform.
Say.
Yeah, all the platforms.
Right.
Yeah, it'll be out there. VOD. Yeah. Go get it.
Thank you, guys. Let's do it again.
Definitely. Let's do this again on the next one.
Thank you.
Thanks, Adam.
Well, thank you, everybody. Thank you kindly. I am definitely in growth mode with the podcast. I have a lot of plans with it, so I think you'll see changes and modifications, but nothing to the tone or the essence of the podcast. But I'm just trying to move it along. We're putting all my effort into it. It requires a lot of work, and your support is immeasurably important. I can't stress it enough. If you could, go to iTunes and pause the show right now. Go to iTunes and leave a star rating, please. And of course, I'm assuming you're subscribed already. But if you're not, do subscribe and leave a star rating for me. And that it only takes a few moments. You can literally do that in 1 or 2 minutes, be done with it. And there's also, you can leave comments, which are nice and helpful and supportive to know I'm out there. So thank you. You know you can reach me through social media. We are on Facebook. If you go to facebook.com/filmwaxradio. And of course, we're on Twitter at filmwaxradio. And guess what? I finally got the Instagram account going, headline news. So we are also on Instagram now. If you search Filmwax on Instagram, I'm sure you can connect with us through that as well. Put up photos from the show, guests, and other events that are related to the podcast. So That's that. I can talk a little bit about what's coming up in the next few shows. I'm going to get back to posting some shows from South by Southwest. We have a little bit more coming up. We have a segment with the filmmakers behind this beautiful film called God Bless the Child, which you will hear a lot more about in the coming months. And then, of course, Todd Rohall and Kent Osborne with their film Uncle Kent 2. It's a great, great segment. And then Yen Tan, who is a filmmaker and a graphic artist, designer out of Austin. That will also, all three of those segments recorded in South by Southwest a month or so ago. And we'll finally have that. We will also have segments with Chris Dubeck and Bill Wise, and also Heather Kafka and Johnny Mars, two pairs of Austin-based actors. And that will be also post in the coming couple of weeks, which will finally conclude my South by Southwest coverage. So it's taken me a while. I apologize for that. Also coming up on the podcast, we have the comedy entrepreneur, Jeffrey Gurian. We have Mark LaFia, who is an experimental filmmaker, and I've been late posting that show. We have the British filmmaker, Thomas Leach, who made a wonderful documentary, which I recently came around to, got to know Thomas and thought, let's sit down and talk. We have a segment with the Hamptons International Film Festival programmer, David Nugent. We have, as I mentioned earlier, a conversation with the Dallas-based actor, Frank Mosley, and much, much more. Yet to be posted, I have a conversation with Joshua Oppenheimer, the actor Bruce Greenwood. So much more sitting idly, waiting for the right opportunity to post, but I will soon. Anyway, I don't want to give up. There's a lot more exciting stuff planned, but hasn't been done yet, so I don't want to talk about it, but it will be coming up soon. So thank you for listening to the podcast, everybody. It means all the world to me. And like I say, reach out, let me know you're there, and I appreciate it. You can go to filmwaxradio.com. There's a way to get in touch. You can email us through there and find out all the exciting stuff that's going on with the show. Thank you so much. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Filmwax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Until next time.
When the night has come and the land is dark and the moon is the only light we'll see, no, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid, just as long as you stand by me. So darling, darling, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Oh, stand by me. Stand by me. If the sky that we look upon should tumble and fall, or the mountain should crumble.